This is the Recorded Conversations Podcast, the podcast dedicated to compassionately considering all perspectives while engaging in an authentic, connected dialogue. I'm Danielle Kingstrom. Welcome back to the show. This is episode 120. And today, my husband, Corey Kingstrom, joins the conversation. And we hopscotch all over the place with topics. We're going to start off with conflict because I received a complimentary copy of Julie Schwartz Gottman and John Gottman's latest book, Fight Right, How Successful Couples Turn Conflict into Connection. And I'd like to thank Harmony Books for that complimentary gift. And I want to recommend that you go grab this book right now because it is life-changing. If you struggle with conflict, if you don't have a proper conflict resolution plan, I urge you to go find this book, Fight Right, listen to it on Audible, or buy yourself a hard copy, buy yourself an ebook, whatever it is. Keep this book handy. Keep this book in a place where you have quick access to grab it because it is chock full of resources and tips to help you get through even the biggest conflicts. After we discuss a little bit of the book, we're going to jump around and we share our thoughts on the internet authentication bill, whether or not anonymous users should be protected, or do we all need to verify our identity when using the internet? Then we jump into the red pill agenda. And if you caught the last episode, episode 119, you'll remember that I discussed the red pill movement and how it is negatively impacting men all across the country. From there, we do a little briefing on what is stoicism. And then we jump into how do abandonment issues create more conflict in your relationship. So I invite you listeners to compassionately consider the perspective of my guest, my husband, Corey Kingstrom. Enjoy the episode. All right. Oh, here, let's toast.
Toast.
Oh, they didn't clink. Make them clink. There we go. Happy birthday, honey.
Thanks, baby.
Thanks for recording a podcast with me on your birthday.
You're welcome. Any way I can spend time with you, I try to appreciate.
I love that. So have you read any good books lately?
Yes.
Which one?
The Gottman Fight Right book. Yeah. Oh, that one's phenomenal. To be fair, technically, I did not read it. I listened to it.
Tomato, tomato. We won't get caught up in that right now, but I also read the book because I received a complimentary copy from Harmony Books, who published Fight Right. So, FYI, I got a free gift out of that, so I want to make sure we talk about that book, and I'll be talking about it on future podcasts, too. But, any great takeaways from it? Anything that resonated?
There was a lot of reassurances for me. Like, I always knew that how you present conflict within a relationship, how you go to the other person, made a difference. And I think they confirmed that. If you go to your partner soft, not aggravated, like, hey, honey, I have an issue. Mm-hmm. They're going to be far more willing to listen to you and try to find a resolution to that conflict. But if you go in attack mode, it's not going to turn out right.
Right. You've been saying for years it's all about your approach.
Yeah.
Like for anything.
Anything.
Anything. It's all about your approach.
And I also, another quick takeaway, slightly different topic, but another thing they said that I've said for a long time is perception is everything.
Yeah.
Like, and I believe that. And so it was nice hearing that from a
Expert
level.
Yeah. You don't think I'm expert level?
Well, you've agreed with me on those things, but I mean, okay.
I don't have a PhD. I got it.
Well, okay, so there have been a couple times where you've pushed back on me on that, too.
That's true, but that's because I was emotional.
But even when we've talked just like this, you're like, well, because we get into the whole intention versus
impact
debate.
I still don't know how to wrestle with that. I mean, because I take both sides. I take one side in some instances, and I take another side in another, and I think I'm just working out ideas still, too, and seeing how they work for me in practice. You know, because, like, I don't understand ideas unless I've experienced them, really. You know, does that make sense?
Yep.
And so if I haven't, like, folded it into my life somehow, it's just a bunch of words that I'm saying. And so, like, even just recently, I was watching a video about intent and impact, and I was like, people say, well, the impact matters more. But, you know, from, like, communication courses and stuff, it's like, well, your intention matters. So that's why you have to be mindful with your words and impeccable with your words, right? And so long as you do that, then you focus on the intention. But sometimes that almost means dismissing the impact.
And so the one thing that...
So it's both.
Yes, it is.
So I'm not done talking yet, but anyway. So anyway, what I'm saying is it's hard to even, like, take a stance on that. What matters more? It's, do they matter more or do they both matter? You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'm done now.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think they both matter, but, like, even the Gottmans almost, they reference this in their book about how sometimes you gotta take a pause and say, oh, that's not what I meant.
Mm-hmm.
Can I rephrase?
Yeah.
And I think during conversations and even conflict, people forget to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They just run with what was said and don't consider, you know, I mean, it's like we're always looking for the worst in people.
Yeah, including our partners when we're fighting. Like, mm-hmm. we always act like we're against each other.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so I don't think people consider that. If you're always looking for the worst in people, you will find it.
Or if you're always looking to blame someone. In the book, too, they divert away from that. They say, this isn't important, this isn't relevant. And it's not about who started what. It's about expressing the emotions that were felt and addressing the situation that stimulated the emotions and then expressing what you need out of that if it was because some need wasn't fulfilled.
Yep.
Yeah.
The other big quote they said a lot in that book was, solve the moment, not the conflict.
Yeah.
Which made me, in the back of my head when they said that, it brought me back to something you had said of kind of your being the present moment thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't worry about what was done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Or what I said in the past, right now is what I'm feeling. And I'm like, oh, that's what she meant by that.
Yeah. 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 And that actually is, like, one of the obstacles in a lot of our conflicts is that bringing back stuff that's outside of the moment and not realizing that, like, yeah, at one point I might have said that in that situation because I was feeling that way at that day, but it's a new moment now.
So, this big statistic I got, which kind of correlates to what we were talking about, are reoccurring conflicts, I guess you could say, is, like, what, 69% of conflict within marriages is the same conflict over and over and over again?
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, within our marriage, you bring that up a lot. We always fight about the same thing. Well, yeah, we're gonna.
Mm-hmm.
20 years from now, and we're still married, old and decrepit, we're still going to be fighting over the same shit.
I mean, but are we? I mean, so I haven't finished the book, but are we? Does there never come to a point where we recognize this is a redundant conflict that is unresolvable and we're done with it?
Nope.
So it's always, just always going to be this always, piece of emotional baggage.
Yep,
that...
Yep. One of the things they talked about was they interviewed couples and they brought them back 20 years later and they were still fighting about the same thing.
What is it you think we fight about the most redundantly?
Chores a lot. I see correlation with all of our conflict.
Yeah.
It's like there's a, a theme behind a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And it's reoccurring. It might be a different trigger. You know, one day it might be I didn't put my shoes away. Another day it might be I didn't finish the laundry or something like that. And frustration, from what I see from you, is still the same. It's been that way for 18 years.
So if I think about just those things that you brought up, I'm thinking about how in those moments, I think I didn't feel considered. Does that make sense?
Yep.
You know, and it's funny that it's about like chores or whatever. For whatever reason, tidiness makes me feel considered. I don't know. I'm just thinking about especially the shoes thing. It's not even, he doesn't listen to me. It's, why doesn't he consider me? Why doesn't he remember I've tripped over shoes? But you didn't have the experience.
Yep.
I did. You just got my anger about it.
Yep.
You know, but for me, that's what it, I don't, maybe that was a fearful moment for me.
Could have been.
And yeah. And so every time that happens, I'm always like, I just don't feel considered.
So something I was just thinking about as well was, so your childhood, it was instilled in you to be clean and tidy.
It was beaten into me.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's a trigger for you. Yeah. If something's not clean and tidy, it brings you back to that time period and like has to be done. So it caused conflict. But another consistent conflict that we've had, it hasn't been as much lately, is me working so much.
Yeah.
Okay. So my childhood trauma is I'm supposed to work. There's no excuse not to work.
Yeah.
You have to go to work.
Yeah.
Provide for your family.
Yeah.
Be at work.
Yeah.
So that's my program, mm-hmm. which has been one of the big conflict sources between
you know,
us.
You say that. You know, it's so funny. I was watching a Chris Rock video, and he was talking about, no, for real, women are never satisfied. They're mad at you. You work too much. You work too much. You're never home. I never see you. And then you don't work. You're home all the time. Why are you home all the time? Why are you always up under me? Why are you here? And the work thing, I think is such a repetitive conflict in a lot of marriages because you want to be together, but it's hard to be like, well, I miss you and I just want to be with you. So you get angry about it because that makes you sound weak and dependent. And so then you just get mad about it. But, you know, that's not even inviting either. Getting mad at you about it is not going to be like, oh, you know what? I wish I was home right now.
It brings back some of my frustrations around that very topic. You know, you got frustrated with me for how much I work. Well, in the summer, I get laid off, and then I'm home.
Yeah.
And
I'm like, can you go away?
Why are you here so much? You know, and same thing with household chores, right? When I'm working, I don't do as much around the house. And so you're frustrated, but with me for not helping out, but then during the summer I'm doing a lot more
and then
stuff.
I don't have anything to then, fucking do
and then you don't have anything, so you get mad at me because you don't have anything to do.
That must be what causes the divorce. If chores are one of the most commonly cited reasons, the division of chores, division of labor, something tells me, this is just my theory because this is what I've come to understand, is when a woman finally does get her man to start helping out, now he's a little too efficient. And she's over here like, what the fuck is the point of me? And that can make you feel icky and low and like worthless to a degree.
Yeah.
You know, because it's taking away from what you have to do in that day and what gives that day meaning for you or whatever. And whatever productivity, you know, status that you're trying to achieve. Because I often notice that. I'm like, even to the degree, like you do the laundry, some days I'm like, why don't I just do the laundry? But then I paint, right? So mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to pursue what I'm passionate about and I'm going to do something. But yeah, sometimes when you are home, I'm like, I'm just going to go hang out in my office because he's going to do everything. Yep. And I like it, but then also I'm like, what am I supposed to do? I'm bored.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. It's so funny. It's like you get what you want and then you complain about it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's silly.
A little bit.
It is what it is. Right?
Basically, yeah.
Yeah. So what else did you get out of the book that you liked?
Well, conflict style you know, that was kind of a...
Oh, recognizing
recognize them? The conflict style and, all the fact that you and I have a slightly differing opinion about which conflict styles we are. Well, I think we're pretty much in agreement about your conflict style. It's my conflict style we might differ on which one I am.
Yeah, because I think we are the volatile couple.
Yes.
And you think you're more conflict avoidant.
No, the other one.
Validating?
Yeah, I think I tend to lean probably more validating than I do. I don't think I'm avoidant because I do bring up conflict. It's not, and even when you bring up conflict, it's not that I don't want, that I want to avoid the conflict. It's that I want to have a conversation about it, which is a validating trait. Now, I do have some volatile tendencies at times. I'm very well aware of that, but I think I'm closer to validating than I am.
So, the volatile couple has no problem expressing emotion. It's completely natural for them. Their fights immediately move into heated debate with high emotion and raised voices, but often with a lot of humor and positivity as well. The complete opposite of avoidant couples, these couples tend to have plenty of overlap in their roles and responsibilities domestically and within the relationships, and they debate and verbally wrestle over them frequently. They might even seem to enjoy arguing. For volatiles, this is in part how they connect. That whole description just made me think of me and you. I know you probably like to think that you're emotionally contained, my love, but sometimes I think I'm coming in soft and you get like explosive and I'm like, whoa, shit, I really was trying to be like intentional about this. So that's why I saw us as volatile. Like, and I'm being brutally honest, right? I'm thinking about how we are when we are the least optimal, you know, embodied self. We're volatile.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I guess...
Read the validating one, okay?
Okay. The validating couple... Validators can look similar to the second type of avoiders above. The difference is they do disagree and they aren't afraid to get into it. They'll debate, they'll accept each other's influence, they'll work on compromise, they'll try to persuade each other and of their own point of view, something avoiders aren't interested in at all. They'll problem solve and work to come up with a new way forward. They tend to be calmer in conflict, but they aren't content to agree to disagree. They want to get somewhere.
So that's how I thought of myself a lot. Because I'm not afraid of debating you. You know what I mean?
But do you see me as a validator?
No, I don't think so. No, you're a volatile. And that's not bad.
I know it's not bad.
So I think that's could be the root of some of our conflict. Is we don't have the same language.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
We deal with the conflict differently, which is sometimes why you think I'm trying to avoid it.
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that I'm trying to dismiss you, and that's a common thing you say to me. Why are you dismissing? I'm not trying to dismiss you. I'm trying to understand. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then that's one of the things they say between the mismatch is those types of couples will tend to... especially volatile people, will tend to think that the other two are dismissive because they won't be volatile with you.
Because you won't match my energy.
I won't match your energy.
That's true. You try to, like, not match my energy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, again, that doesn't mean I don't have some volatile tendencies because, yes, I can get that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I try not to be. I think I tend, again, all three of those are on a spectrum. You know, you've got avoidant on one end of the line and you've got volatile on the other end of the line. And
you got a bunch in between.
Bunch in between. And I think I tend to lean slightly towards, not a lost
validating.
Word, validating versus volatile. But
yeah.
I do have some volatile tendencies.
Hmm. Yeah. All right, I'll give you that. And so then you get this A Better Way to Fight PDF with the book. that talks about the softened startup, which is a formula for like addressing conflict, which I think is something we've tried to implement in the past anyway. Yep. Don't you think? Like we've used similar structures like this.
Yeah, I think we try to, you know, it's not always effective. But
well,
we
it's
try.
Hard to do when you're activated. Yeah. So that's why you print it out and staple it and put it right there where you're going to argue. The fridge one, the fridge idea about, what was that part?
Yeah, the story about the little girl that this couple would fight. They hung the cheat sheet on their fridge. Yeah. And whenever they were struggling with conflict, they would go to the fridge and they would use the flow chart to get through the conflict. Mm-hmm. And then the story goes that the mom got upset with the 2 or 3 year old daughter, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And so the 2 or 3 year old daughter took the mom to the fridge to address the conflict.
Yeah. Yeah. And so was it this cheat sheet? Probably. So I've been handing this softened startup out to like everybody that I've seen present a problem, right? Like I go on Reddit and I read shit and I'm like, here's a good formula for conflict. You know, I throw it in there. Or I'm like, oh, have you heard of this new book? And da da da. And I talk about the softened startup. But it starts out with just owning your feelings with I statements. I feel hurt. I feel abandoned, left out, whatever. And then about the specific behavior, not a pattern of behavior. And what I always add on is as an amendum is the people are not the problem. The problem exists between two people. And I think they kind of say something similar in their book, too. It's like, that's why we take blame and fault out of the equation, because that's not what it's about. And so then you just, and I say, address the action or the attitude or the behavior or the unmet need that you recognize was going on in that situation. Don't say, you did this, unless you're talking about the behavior. Don't, like, throw it all at the personhood. And so, what is the situation that upset me? And then, what do I need to not feel upset? And that's about figuring out what your needs are. And then I always have a needs list that I give to clients. Find what your needs are, and this is how we address them.
To go along with that, something else that stood out to me was they are adamantly opposed to criticism.
Of any kind.
Any kind of criticism. Yeah,
and for years, I've been like, constructive criticism is okay.
No? And they basically say, constructive criticism is BS.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and so that hit me, kind of. Like, what do you do with that?
Yeah.
Does that same thing apply to parent-children dynamic? I totally get it within an intimate relationship, because you're kind of equals, but if you're trying to teach,
well, but
you know what I mean?
Are we like, equal in value and worth still as humans?
Yeah. No.
So rather than use criticism, you encourage the behavior you want to see. You don't focus on the behavior that upsets you, right?
Yeah.
And so if there's an attitude, there are so many adjectives that you can use that can leave like a stain, I think. And any form of criticism is judgment, essentially.
Yeah.
And do you need to judge your kids?
Yeah.
No.
Well, yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. Like I know a lot of people, I think a lot of people try and separate that though. Like they act like their children are like almost less than the humanness that their spouse is. And so they don't deserve respect or consideration or compassion.
Well, let's be honest though, but we should probably start with our spouse. if you can get to be that way with your spouse, where you don't criticize your spouse and you do soft starts and you focus on emotions and things like that, it will probably be much easier to bring that to your children.
Yeah. Well, and essentially, your romantic relationship is where you learn how to really love. Mm-hmm. And that love spills out. And then you learn how to love other people just as compassionately. Obviously not the same, but that's, I think that kind of epitomizes kind of a theory we were trying to work out years ago about love and how it influences those in your proximity. right? Mm-hmm. And how it spills out. But, and if we're not loving our spouses, like, fully and optimally, I would argue we wouldn't even know how to love our children properly. Mm-hmm.
In this segment of the episode, Corey and I are going to be discussing our thoughts on internet identity authentication. And what spurred this conversation is really just how disgusting and sickening it can be to engage on social media and to realize that for so many people, that cloak of anonymity prevents them from facing any true consequences of saying whatever the hell they want to say on the internet. So here are our thoughts.
Like, you should have to have repercussions for that.
Yeah.
But then do employers get to fire you if you're pro-life or if you're pro-choice or if you're, you know what I mean? Like
showing pictures of your cleavage all over your Twitter while also representing your business?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of...
What are you entitled to do in this existence?
Yeah, and do we really want the government involved in deciding that? So the anonymity thing, I'm torn on because there's extremes to both sides and I don't like either extreme.
What do you mean?
The whole employers being able to...
And the government basically having a list of every user.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
But then also the good part about that is you don't have anonymous perverts and trolls and just idiots and bots.
Yep.
You have authenticated you're a real fucking person.
Yep. I'm gonna break it down in the simplest terms. Mm-hmm. You have the individuals who can be idiots, or you have the government. Which do you want?
But what about when the idiots start doxing people and stalking people and harming people?
Same can be said for the government.
And you don't know how to figure out who that person was because they have an anonymous account and they use some, I don't even know the terminology, to hide their real IP address. And I don't know.
And what if the government... does what it does.
But then I'm over here like, well, I'm not posting anything the government doesn't like yet.
No, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know.
I would rather the individuals have
your
the freedoms anonymity. To choose what they want to do than the government have control. That's where I sit right now. And yes, you have a lot of stupid people. You get the red pill movement. You get the... you know, far left leaning. Yeah, it's all, yeah, you're going to have that.
But so now it's not the government destroying us anymore, though. It's the people. I mean, because really, look, I mean, all these people, everybody is so, divide, controversy, inflame people, get them mad, orgasmic outrage, divide, disconnect. They're your enemy. I mean, the people are doing it now. Like the government doesn't even have to run a PSYOPs program. You know what I mean? The government doesn't have to have a fun little hidden secret agenda. The people are doing it to themselves now.
Okay, so here's a thought. What if the government initiated that process so that they could take control?
Which government?
Doesn't matter.
China? Russia?
Ours.
France?
I don't fear Chinese government. I don't fear any of them.
You don't think
I fear our government.
Yeah.
You know, what if that was the whole plan all along?
Give us the internet and then have us destroy it so they can take it away?
What if the government created the red pill movement?
The red pill movement is trying to convince men to be gay and submit to other men now. Whatever that means. And to submit to their country. Submit to your country and to men and to God. But men first. And I'm like, what? What is... what? You want who to get on their knees for whom? For why?
It would not surprise me if the government was behind this whole thing.
Like Andrew Tate and Rollo Tomasi and 100%. Red Pill Agenda, yeah. Manosphere.
And then you know, the same on the opposite side. It's division. Keep us separated. Because if
the black and white division, the rich and poor division.
Exactly.
The trans and cis division.
Because that's the only way government can keep control.
To keep us divided.
Keep us divided.
Who worked out that logic, though, that that's provable? Like, I'm just curious.
Well, think about it from a congressional standpoint, right?
If
we're all divided, we're going to keep voting left and right. And so we're basically pointing fingers that the opposite is the bad party, when in actuality, they're probably just working together. They're trying to keep us divided so they can shove stuff into the bills that we don't even know about.
And just get rich off of our taxes.
Exactly.
Making us indentured servants for the rest of our lives.
Basically, yeah.
Fantastic. I mean, that's a clever theory. But here's what I say. How come we didn't fall for it? Why are all these other people falling for it and being brainwashed?
One, we're married and we have each other and we try to avoid all that shit.
We do isolate in a bubble.
Yeah.
A small bubble.
No, we're not slowing it down or stopping it either. You know what I mean? I think there's a lot of people out there like us who don't participate in that. I think the people on the social media that are, even the red pill movement, is probably like 2% of the population.
I don't know.
I mean, look at the trans agenda. You know, that's all over everywhere.
Yeah.
It's 2% of the population.
I don't think it's 2%. Well, maybe it became 2% because, you know, a million other idiots jumped on the fucking cut myself up bandwagon, but yeah.
So it's like 2% of the, it's just what is coming to our attention. Now, I do believe the division is real. I mean, you see that in the elections. You know, there's a real divide.
You see that everywhere.
Yeah.
You see that in the Real Housewives, okay? It's like everywhere.
But I don't think the full hatred exists for people that what is being portrayed on the internet. You know what I mean?
Are you sure?
I think that
everything that's on the internet, just what isn't real?
I think that people have the freedom because of the anonymity to say those things.
But
I don't think
people are being really horrible to each other in real life.
Sure, there's some, but I don't think that's the general. I think it's a small amount of people.
It's
just being thrown in our faces.
Yeah. And it becomes a trending topic, so millions of people are talking about it.
Exactly.
Even though it probably only impacted like 12 people in some small city no one's heard of.
Exactly. I mean, that doesn't mean that horrible things don't happen, but I think most of the people are civil to one another and care for one another.
But at which point is it no longer a program and an agenda and an individual responsibility to not perpetuate this? You know what I mean? When I'm like, why are we different? It's like, so then how come we can see that there's this idea of an agenda and a program, but like, why are we exempt from it? And then are we still going to say, well, they don't know what they're doing. They're being programmed. They know what they're doing.
Okay, so like the people, let's take some of the red pill movement, for example. I mean, a lot of those men and maybe even some women, I mean, they are truly hurt. They have a reason they're there.
Yeah.
They got hurt and they don't know how to rebound from it. And that story was appealing and they fell into it. We've done the same thing. We've been in, you know, we went through the Fox News phase where, you know, yeah. I mean, so you get into a group that makes you feel good.
Oh, they're going through a deconstruction process.
And, you know, that's where they're stuck right now.
With these cliche regurgitators.
Yeah. Now, you know, something or someone could pull them out of it. But,
love. Love well.
But they could be stuck there a while, too.
There are more and more men leaving disenfranchised and disillusioned from the red pill, right? And it sounds like the people who do leave, the majority of the, like, ex-red pillers, they're not in there that long.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 2 to 5 years.
Yeah.
And then, for whatever reason, they have a wake-up call.
Yeah.
And they realize, oh, this is not actually doing anything for me.
Yeah.
And they've spent, you know, thousands of dollars in these red pill men's programs, the the alpha male cult program coaching program.
But you never know. Maybe that's the program that got him out of that.
It could have been.
You know, I mean, you can't go back and say that that money was necessarily wasted because...
I'm not saying all the stuff that even... I've heard Andrew Tate say smart shit. You know what I mean? I've agreed with some of the things Pearl has said. But that's in very minimal context. Their overall presentation just is a walking contradiction.
Oh, yeah.
And... I mean, sure, we all contradict ourselves once in a while, maybe, or maybe some of us just change our minds, but, so I'm not saying they're, like, 100% disastrous. That's why they work. That's why they're popular, is because some of the shit they say does make sense. I'll listen to a bunch of Kevin Samuel videos today, and I'm like, you goddamn that's right. Yep. You know, he said some smart shit. He said some shit that needed to be said. I mean, just listening to him talk to other men, I was like, yeah, you tell him. You know? So, I get it. They're appealing, they're charismatic, they're good looking, they're dressed nice, they're rich, and they're selling the money scam, right? Follow me, take my coaching program, work with me, and you'll get rich. You'll become a nine. Your status will increase. And maybe 1% of men experience that gratifying transformation. But something tells me, along the way, a majority of these men drop out of the programs.
So, I guess I kind of view the red pill movement like I view the deconstructionist movement.
A necessary evil?
Well, not necessarily that. It's just, it's a step on the path.
Yeah.
You know, like, we all change our minds. We all...
Yeah.
Changing is inevitable. And that just happens to be a place that you stop along the way.
Yeah.
You know, and there's things you can learn in those realms, but it's probably not a good idea to settle there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, some of these dudes' programs, they talk about different philosophers. A lot of them focus on Stoic philosophy, obviously, but... And so, I mean, that's helpful. Some of these men probably never even heard of Stoicism or Marcus Aurelius or, you know, and so that's good. And those practices and principles are good. They help you develop masculinity. That's good. But I think a lot of these people are also developing inflated egos and really objectifying lenses over women.
You know, I've heard you talk about Stoicism, mention that term multiple times, and I still can honestly say I have no idea what it is.
I shall tell you. Stoicism is a school of Hellenistic philosophy that flourished in ancient Greece and ancient Rome. The Stoics believed that the practice of virtue is enough to achieve eudaimonia, a well-lived life, or... The Stoics identified the path to achieving it with a life spent practicing the four virtues in everyday life: wisdom, courage, temperance, or moderation, and justice, and by living in accordance with nature. It was founded in the ancient Agora of Athens by Zeno of Citium around 300 BC. That doesn't really give you anything, does it? Let me tell you.
Well, I kind of got an idea, I guess.
Stoicism teaches the development of self-control as a means of overcoming destructive emotions. The philosophy holds that becoming a clear and unbiased thinker allows one to understand the universal reason, logos. Stoicism's primary aspect involves improving the individual's ethical and moral well-being. Virtue consists in a will that is in agreement with nature. The principle also applies to the realm of interpersonal relationships. To be free from anger, envy, and jealousy, and to accept even slaves as equals of other men because all men alike are products of nature.
It's not all horrible.
No, I don't think Stoicism is horrible. I think it is misinterpreted and poorly practiced. The idea to deny negative emotions... I mean, obviously in the field of psychology, it's like, well, be careful you don't suppress those emotions. But I think too many people equate that with don't be emotional. Mm-hmm. And so Stoicism is heavily constructed from concepts like logic, right? And so you throw stoicism and logic and men are logical thinkers around, and suddenly men are like, that's right, everything I think is logical. It's not emotional. So I'm dropping facts and reason, and like, I think they just misinterpret everything. And then alignment with nature. I've heard a lot of red pill people talk about this is about being in alignment with your primitive nature and your instinctual nature. And I'm like, oh, what is that now exactly? And it's like everything. It's about universe and oneness. And so I just think the practices are just misinterpreted and not put to good use.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That is all. But I also didn't really put a lot of time into studying it either. I just wasn't drawn to it. I have Marcus Aurelius, and his Meditations is a pretty good sampling of the philosophy kind of in practice from his view.
And I wonder if there's like an audible book, like a 90-minute about Stoicism to understand it a little bit anyway.
Yeah, and so like as far as like, so the Stoics arranged the passions under four headings: distress, pleasure, fear, and lust. So distress is an irrational contraction or a fresh opinion that something bad is present, at which people think it right to be depressed. Fear is an irrational aversion or avoidance of an expected danger. Lust is an irrational desire or pursuit of an expected good, but in reality bad. Delight is an irrational swelling or fresh opinion. So these are kind of some of the ideas. I was like, I don't like all that shit. So I've just been immersed in red pill ideology for the last like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Researching studies on red pill groups, on the manosphere, on the incel epidemic, on the male loneliness epidemic. And I want to have empathy. But it's shit like this. Andrew Tate's poll on Twitter. Which would you rather have? An attractive woman who shuts up every time you tell her to, but is broke, stupid, and boring, or a super smart, very rich, and interesting woman who constantly talks back? 68% said shuts up. 32% says the other one. Men don't want a woman who talks. He doesn't care if she has money. What is she? She just needs to look good and have holes, but not for talking, just for what, my dick? And this is what men want?
Okay, so is that a true poll?
Well, I took a screenshot of it in real time. No, it's not done yet. Is it a true poll? As to what?
So think about who actually saw that poll.
Well, 250,000 people saw it.
Yep, of people who are in his algorithm.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a biased poll.
Yeah.
You got to take it for what it's worth. Did 250,000 people take that vote? Yep. There's what? That's like asking, doing a poll of Republicans on who's pro-life. You know?
Okay, but still, the users are participating on Twitter in this poll. They're men, and they don't want a woman who talks. What and is that?
They're probably all single.
Well, of course. I mean, even Andrew Tate is single. Duh.
Exactly.
Like, how does he think he's going to teach men how to get women when he doesn't have one? So then what's the remedy for this? Like, are we going to find a remedy? Are we going to have, like, the great divide? Revolution?
I think... War? I think the remedy is closeness on an intimate level. Like, people within your proximity. That's the only way you can change.
That's the only way you can influence people is through intimacy.
Through an intimate connection, like someone you know and are close to.
Yeah, but that's true, right? Like, and I think we've already talked about this.
Numerous times.
And it's true, right? Because you don't really start to change your mind until you have a personal experience, relative experience, something that is in your physical proximity. And maybe that's what it is for the men who leave the red pill. Maybe they find a spark and a connection with a woman and then are like, what the fuck have I been doing?
Maybe it's a family member. Yeah. Or maybe it's...
But then it's still... Even if they snap out of it, it leaves such a path of destruction.
Most things do.
I want to know, how do you prevent people from entering into this manosphere?
Thinking back to one of the books I read. I think it was Esther Perel
about State of Affairs.
State of Affairs. When she talks about infidelity, she states, and I know this from personal experience, I would never wish infidelity on any couple. That being said, sometimes it takes an event so big to get you to say, oh shit, something's not right. Going back to the red pill, maybe either there was an event that led them up that previous to the red pill that said, oh shit, something's not right. And so they started searching for answers. And this is a stop. Or maybe the red pill movement is the event. You don't know. But sometimes it takes something pretty extreme to get you to say, I need to change my life.
Yeah. You think that's what the infidelity did for you?
Yeah, to a point. It at least got me to start thinking differently.
About anything in particular?
My own personal, the ways I saw things. You know, the whole me being deployed, right? I was in that whole idea of, I'm doing this for my country and everybody should be, you know, you just have to accept it. But when you told me that I abandoned you, I pushed against that for quite some time. But as I've gotten older and really evaluated that, the reality is I did. And it doesn't justify you cheating on me, but I did abandon you. I created an environment where that was a possibility. And so how often do we do that within relationships? You know, I look back even on a lot of our fights, you know, like things you get frustrated for with me about, like, okay, but did you create an environment where that was going to be the result, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we don't do that enough. The whole personal accountability thing.
And examine the environment we're cultivating.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily justify the other person's actions. It just, okay, well, this person did those actions because they were put in a bad spot in some way. They were put in a spot where they had to choose, and they chose wrong.
Yeah.
So maybe instead of worrying so much about how they choose, let's not put them in that bad spot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because more or less, they had to choose from options available in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it was
like, and neither option might have been a good option.
Yeah.
But if you're stuck with options, well, okay, we look at these two options and they're both not real great. Well, how the hell did we get to where we only had two options? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think taking accountability can ever be seen as justifying a poor behavior or action, though. I think that's kind of the point of accountability. Accountability is addressing the action, stepping into awareness of it, apologizing for it, and putting a plan of action to not repeat it. And I think that's what activates when we have serious conflicts, is that fear of abandonment comes up into play. Mm-hmm. Especially in the past when, like, you've thrown the D word around.
Yeah, that's not right. Sometimes I just need to be away. Like, and that's reiterated in Fight Right.
Like, physically remove yourself from the energy.
I have to take a break.
And then not think about it. So that's the thing that I haven't been doing.
Me too.
Right? Like,
guilty.
Take yourself out of the room, take a break, but then do something different. Like, do not just sit and think about it. And I'm like, yeah, why don't I take a break and go for a walk, or take a break and, I don't know, play my stupid game, or go do yoga, yeah, or yeah, cook something, whatever. It's like, yeah, that's the thing I...
Another thing they talk about a lot is have a kiss.
Yeah.
A touch.
Yeah.
I mean, I try a lot.
You do.
You know?
You do. And I'm like, what? No, fuck you. I don't want to kiss right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not like...
That's a repair attempt.
Yeah, well, not only a repair attempt, but, and I've said this to you before, too, it's like, okay, I don't like you right now, but I still love you, I ain't going nowhere, but I need a break. I know we just have to reset here. We gotta do something different.
But I think the touching thing, too, you know that your touch calms me. You know it does.
I also know your touch calms me.
Yeah, and so if we just touch each other, mm-hmm. it in a way, you can, that creates safety, mm-hmm. right? It's that physical reminder of, oh yeah, this person is safe.
But maybe that would help with your abandonment issues.
Yeah.
You know that I touch you.
Yeah, you're okay, here. You're I'm not here. Going anywhere.
I'm here.
Yeah.
We can try again tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no. Yeah, I really like all of their repair attempts.
I think for the most part, we're okay at repair attempts.
Yeah. In their flooding chapter, all this stuff, they talk about the repair checklist for what I can first say when I'm feeling something, like I'm feeling scared or I'm feeling underappreciated, or even to be like, please don't lecture me. How we can talk to each other to remind each other that we're going to get activated, and to just be like, hey, this is how I'm feeling right now. And I think we do that, but we're good at telling each other when we need to calm down or take a break now. But even the little things like, yeah, I can understand what you mean. Yeah, I get what you're saying. You do that a lot too, I notice. All right, go ahead and tell me what I'm good at.
Expressing your emotions. I'm not good at that. That was a big thing I noticed about myself. Okay, so two things I noticed about myself that I really got to work on. Being able to express my emotions. Even when you ask me, how are you feeling? I freeze. I don't even know how to answer that question. I don't know what to do with that. And then the flooding thing. I'm pretty sure I get flooded a lot, which is part of the reason why I don't think I'm a volatile, by the way. Because volatiles are hard to get flooded. Because they're just amped a lot.
But you still think I'm volatile?
Yeah, because you're amped a lot. You don't get flooded. Okay? I think I do.
Okay.
So that's part of the reason why I think I'm not full-fledged volatile. But just being able to articulate that and having vocabulary that hopefully will help in times of conflict, to just being able to express that, and hopefully you'll be able to accept that and say, okay, yeah, let's take a break.
So I think I obviously have a benefit here in expressing my emotions because of all the stuff I've studied and all the books I've read that are more oriented literally towards doing that. I think I overcomplicate expressing my emotions sometimes.
So one thing I will say maybe you could work on, and it has to do with the soft startup. Sometimes I think you, I don't want to say confuse your emotions for criticism, but you're using the criticism to convey your emotion. Instead of coming to me, you're doing this, yada, 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 I'm feeling this. I know one thing you always tell me is I get defensive, and I even deny I get defensive, even though it's probably defensive. But one of the things they focus on is, if you come with criticism, defensiveness is the only option, really.
Yeah.
You know, and so if you want me to not be defensive, yes, I can work on it, but presentation matters.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, and avoid accusation and criticism.
Yep.
Right? Like, because otherwise we go to each other in a way where we're almost saying, like, you did this on purpose. And you could be like, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yep.
And so, yeah. I notice that is one of my shortcomings. Like, every time I read a new book, I'm like, I gotta get better at that.
Well,
just expressing what I'm feeling. Like, if I'm feeling hurt or sad or whatever. I think I just have too many opposing ideas in my head about what expressing my emotions looks like and what it means. And is it weakness? Is it, mm-hmm. am I just all up in my feels right now? And sometimes I even doubt if I should express my emotions. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that is just because, yeah, I have too much information in my head. So if I say, what are you feeling? That's what you struggle with?
Just yes.
Identifying that emotion?
Yeah.
Connecting that feeling to a word?
Yeah.
there's a handy dandy emotional wheel right there on my desk.
It overwhelms me.
Why?
Because I look at...
It's colorful and coordinated and cute.
It overwhelms me. It's like, that is way too many words.
Stick to the inner five. What are the inner five? Is it rage? Is it joy? Is it disgust? Is it fear? Is it sadness? Is it... What's the other one? Excitement?
It's just... The color wheel, while I love it, I appreciate it, it's overwhelming.
Well, I have a little one you can take.
That was overwhelming.
That was overwhelming? You can't just sit and look at something and...
No, I wanna start looking at them cards more.
So you want me to just write emotions out on cards for
you? No, I wanna look at their cards.
So this is expressing needs, not exactly emotions.
They have some expressing emotions cards.
Oh, those must be new, because I bought the two that they had. That's
they
what
have,
I had at the time.
They have expressing emotions cards as well.
Okay. Because I have expressing empathy, expressing needs, and great listening. And open-ended questions and love maps. I was watching this series of videos where couples sit in front of each other and ask each other open-ended questions. And one of the questions that was asked was, this husband asked his wife, what is the one thing you wouldn't have been able to do without me? And I just started crying as soon as he asked the question. Because I already knew my answer if you were to ask me. And then she started crying. And then I started crying more. And I'm looking at the comments and everyone's like, I'm over here crying over these strangers. And I immediately wrote, my husband taught me how to love myself. And then that's what she said finally when she got through her tears. And I was like, see, that's what love really does. Teaches you how to love yourself. So that you can love fully with others, I think. So, I would not do good recording those open-ended questions like that with you. I think every response would make me cry.
See, I think for me, it is helping me see the strength to do the things I should do. Especially in regards to my family. Before you, at that time, I was really close to my family. You know, I depended on my family for emotional support, and it was kind of toxic. I mean, you had my back a lot, and I didn't see it a lot for a long time, but you did.
Well, they all had such a tainted-ass view of you, I noticed right from the beginning. I was like, you people don't even fucking know them. I hadn't even been with you 6 months, and the way they would talk to me about you, I'm like... I really don't think you know who this person is. And then as the years would go by, they'd even say things like, I know Corey. And I'd be like, no the fuck you don't. Because he is not the person you're saying he is. I remember even before you deployed, do you remember how emotional I got about how your sisters were acting? Mm-hmm. For being so dismissive of you and like making it all about them and their feelings. And then... also just not knowing who you were. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, to a degree, being with you made me realize that, like, my family, some of my family members were pretty fucking toxic, too. And I don't know if I would have ever been able to sever my relationship with my mom, which needed to be done, because she was a lot. Yeah, we strengthen each other, for sure.
Yeah.
Of course I got your back. No one gets to talk shit about you except me.
Fair. Fair.
But I rarely talk shit about you. So there's that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least not to other people. To my face you do.
Well, I mean, to you I do.
I mean.
So, see? I just talk shit to you.
There you go.
Do you need me to ask you about your hopes and aspirations?
You know, they have a whole chapter on that. And I
thought... Oh, the dream.
The dreams. The dreamer. And... that talking dreams.
Oh, it's in this one then, in the shallow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I asked you, that's I think why I brought up that conversation about winning the lottery and is that your real dream? Because I had just read this.
Oh, okay.
And they were talking about that underlying unmet dream, an unfulfilled dream that we all have that somehow gets shut off or shoved away.
So I actually had a conversation with a friend of mine about this. Prior to us moving to where we currently live, I could have told you what my dreams are, like, in some significant detail.
Yeah.
And then all of that happened. And I think for, like, the last 3 years, I've kind of just been lost. Like, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. Mm. You know? I didn't know.
Because your dream was attached to that farm yeah. and that house. And
yeah. And whether or not that was my dream or not, I'm not entirely sure. Doesn't really matter at this point. So, like, for the last 3 years, I really haven't. I've just been kind of walking along aimlessly with not really a plan. And now I think I'm starting to get back into it. I recently had a conversation a couple days ago about, you know, what the last 3 years from a career standpoint has been like. And, you know, when I started my current job, I was burnt out. All I wanted to do was just drive.
Yeah.
That was it. I didn't want any other responsibility. You didn't want to
be a manager, deal with issues. Yeah, I didn't. Just give me a job.
Just put me behind the wheel and let me be alone. Yeah. You know? And that's kind of what I've just done the last 3 years. And now I think I'm getting to the point where I'm ready to get back in the game, I guess, you know, and move forward. But yeah, the last 3 years is kind of, I guess, a midlife crisis for me, you know.
Or just a transformation.
Yeah. Well, same thing in my
reassessment.
Book. I think I'm ready to start moving forward. And then I hope that you and I can continue having conversations about that.
We can. I just got a reading and our relationship is evolving to a new level of commitment. Do you know what I instantly thought? If he had to take a different type of driving position, we'd be okay.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be scared. Can I be honest with you? I remember when we moved to the farm, and even when I first started coming out there, you as a farmer boy didn't work in my head. You were a military man. When we moved to the farm to live there, and then you started taking over, that was weird for me, because I was like, he's not a farmer. He's a military dude. He's a military man. The farming thing was so weird to me in the beginning. But then at the same time, it was really sexy. So I was like, who is this guy? Look at this fucker. He's sexy. Tractors? Shit, I didn't know tractors could turn me on. You know, that kind of thing. But all of that is to say, I think no matter what you do, you excel in it. I thought you were in the military. I just always had this vision of like, that whole place would fall apart without him. He knows what the fuck he's doing. And you just have always had this air of confidence and competency about you. Like, I don't sit there and sometimes I get up in my head and worried about what you're doing. But what gets me out of that is I remind myself he is competent. He is capable. He is smart. He knows what he's doing. He's thought about this. He's not a risk taker. He's not going to do anything stupid, not intentionally. So I think no matter what you do, you'll excel at it, and if you want to advance wherever you are, you will.
Well, I appreciate hearing that.
I have faith in you.